Accession number 27202, Colonel James Dowson, Reel 3. Now, we're talking about these War Office Selection Board tests, and it's quite interesting. How did they pick up these? Do you remember what the tests were that exposed your inability to delegate and lack of...
They're always practical tests where you were given a piece of wood that was too short and a piece of rope that was far too long in order to construct something that was rather unsuitable for carrying out a task. And whereas those, I think, this is very much hindsight and looking back on it a long way, those who succeeded were people who were able to let people get on with solving the problems they gave them. I couldn't do that. I kept on interfering and offering better solutions to the ones that they came up with, all of which would be adequate if I'd left them to it. In other words, they weren't wallowing, they were solving a problem in ways that I thought could be solved better or differently by me, and I could never leave that alone, and still can't.
and that was it. You must have been fairly disappointed, because you were...
I was,
in other
yes.
ways, you must have been clearly opposite material.
Yes, I was very disappointed. And in fact, I got a posting at the end of my basic training. I got a posting to the regular commissions board at Westbury in Wiltshire. We'll tell you about that later.
Okay. So you failed the WASBE tests, but you passed the intelligence and aptitude test. But you're going to stay in the Royal Army Medical Corps.
I was. Yeah.
So we're going still through the day is just a way of hanging out. So you have drill sessions. You've done your aptitude test. What other sessions of training would you have during your basic training?
There were things which were trumpeted as something that was going to put us to the test, like route march and so on, and getting our webbing on. Getting webbing on was really quite a business. It isn't a sort of intuitive, natural thing. Wearing of webbing is a technique that you have to learn, and I learned it a treat. In fact, I thought, this is dead easy. They said, for instance, your small pack, it's got to come as hard up against the back of your neck as it will go, and all that sort of thing. Got to be on tight, otherwise it comes off in battle, in action. And we all had sessions of practice putting this on. And there we were all standing at attention. And the instructor came and said, "You, that's me, out to the front." Oh, God, what's happened now? And he said, "Stand this way. Are you all watching him? Right, turn around." He said, "Can you see that?" And they all sort of muttered. And he said, "That's the way it should go on." Oh, great relief.
Which pattern webbing was it? Or do you know? I mean,
I can't remember. It was a small pack, and it had hooks here with ammunition pouches there, except we didn't have ammunition pouches, being REMC. We had different things. And it had a belt with two brass things on and a clip, which was male and female, and they didn't say it to us, but it's said many times and has gone sort of into history where they say, "And the male goes into the female." Now, that's not too difficult to remember, is it?
So that was one thing. Now, you mentioned route marches. If you look at physical training, PT and physical training generally, route marches would be part of a process. Can you look at the PT side generally, both from what we call PT and physical training?
Again, I did very well at that. The instructors were either regulars or extended national service people. They wore black and red horizontal striped jerseys, and they clearly enjoyed their job, and they got a little perk in humiliating those who were physically less well-developed. They also try to humiliate those like me who are physically quite well developed, and so they'd make us do pull-ups and press-ups and so on to the point of exhaustion, which I cheerfully did, and they got their pleasures out of me.
What about route marches and cross-country runs? Much of that?
Yes, there was a fair bit of that, a fair bit of physical activity. although it's, perhaps it seemed more than it was. We perhaps had, in 12 weeks, they must have had only about 4 route marches, and they got longer and longer.
Did you feel, I mean, the thing about PT is it's meant to build you up. Did you feel you were fitter at the end of the 12 weeks than you were at the start?
Yes, I was fit to start off with, but I was very fit towards the end. As I told you, I've never had any problem getting up early in the morning, so I would... I wake up like that, and that's when I discovered other people didn't, because they would wake up, and remember, in the barrack room, I'd wake up, and before I sat up, there would be a sort of and these great columns of smoke would go from the bed while they lit up their first fag, by which time I was half dressed.
You didn't smoke, or...
Not then. Well, I did a bit later on. It was park drive and things like that I would smoke, but then.
What else? So we've got drill, we've got webbing, we've got PT. Any weapons training? I mean, I know you're RAMC, but...
Yes, we did a bit.
Was basic rifle drill? Or
yes, we did a bit. I think we had to fire something like 10 rounds, but it was, that was all.
So, minimal?
Absolutely minimal, yes.
No bayonet training or,
no,
or machine
none
gun?
Of that. We shot a rifle. We, I don't think we even threw a grenade.
Anything medical during the basic?
Yes, we had first aid. There was a thing called the nursing manual or something like that. And that was the basis of our training. We went through this. It had anatomy, physiology, first aid and nursing procedures. And we learned all that.
Now, tell us a bit more about it. What level was we
nursing taught? Orderly class 3 is what you went out as.
And what did it involve? I mean, a bit more about each of these sections. I mean, how far into the process of did you go?
Well, to be aware of the fact that the human body was made up of bones and muscles and organs and so on, and to know how joints worked, so that we got the difference between hinge joints and ball and socket joints and so on, the functions of the gut and the liver and the lungs and the heart, all of that basic anatomy and physiology. And on that we would then go on to first aid, the use of the various standard things like the triangular bandage and roller bandages.
Now, we've got to pick up these things at some point. So explain a triangular bandage.
Well, a triangular bandage is just a triangular piece of cloth. It would be about 2 feet from apex to base and longer. The base was quite long, so it could be tied in a knot. And you could fold it up to a broad fold or a narrow fold, and you made it into various sorts of slings. If you used it as a triangle, it became a large arm sling. That is, not a large arm, but a large arm sling. you were shown how to do this. You had to put the hand on the shoulder and have the bandage like that, and you'd tie it round the neck, go that way, and the knot was on the non-injured side, and then you'd have it, and then there was the inevitable safety pin there, and we taught how to put that on, fairly simple. And the
and what was the purpose of that? To keep it immobilized and
to mobilize an arm, yes, and keep it out of the way.
And so that's a triangular one.
A triangular bandage, and it was adaptable to various other things. You could use it as a head bandage by folding a little bit round, and then you could use it as a bandage of a joint. Again, similar to the head, except it went round the joint. You were shown how to do that. These are just
any
sort
particular
of
knots you were required.
Reef knot, always the reef knot. You're taught, and it was emphasised to do a reef knot because it laid flat and was comfortable.
Was it one that was easy to undo, or were they cut off?
A reef knot doesn't jam as much, but we were taught that. But in actual fact, I never really thought that was, well, it was easy to comprehend, so you can know how to untie it. Granny knot doesn't jam, but it can look baffling, particularly if it's a compound thing. So if you were taught to do a regular knot, when you came across something that had been done by somebody else, what you expected to find was, because of the insistence on the reef knot, was what you actually found. So somebody else do a bandage, comes along the line, one could comprehend this, comes along the line of evacuation, everything that has been done further up the line exactly resembles what you've been taught. So it was, you didn't have to work out any, you didn't have to solve any problems.
You could quickly untie it without needing to cut it off.
Yeah, that's right.
Now, you mentioned, was it runner bandages?
Roller bandages. They're just ways of putting them on, you see, in a tapering leg. You put a roller bandage on, you start, and you go from the inside to the outside. But when you come to here, it looks a bit untidy, so you did a crossover, and it looked rather neat, sort of crossover. You could, and one could acquire great skill in doing these various things, and sort of hip spikers and things like that, they were called. They're all given technical names, most of which I have thankfully forgotten. And
what about the packs they used to carry in their pockets? I don't know whether they still
first did. Field dressing. Yes.
I mean, were you taught that? Because that's not a bandage. So that's bandages are different
it
from dresses,
really,
aren't they? I mean,
yeah. Bandages and those things were put on top of dressings. The first field dressing and the shell dressing we were taught about. Shell dressing is just like a first field dressing, only bigger, for bigger wounds.
And what is a first field
dressing? It's really a compression dressing. It's a big wadge of material surrounded by gauze, and you put it on the wound and tie it tightly on the wound, and it would act as a to stop bleeding as well as to occlude the wound, cover the wound.
So the idea is it would press against the wound and stop blood coming out, and what did come out it would soak up.
Yes, that's right. That's really what a first field dressing did.
And with bad wounds...
And we were always taught, the important thing was taught, always use the wounded man's first field dressing, not your own. Your own is for you, not him.
And would you use more than one if the wound was bad? Because sometimes you hear people talking about using more than one. I mean...
Well, yes, I suppose you then start to go around and use. But generally speaking, I've never actually used it in combat, so I wouldn't know the answer to that. We were taught that's the thing to do, put it on, and if it was a bigger wound, then we'd expect to use a shell dressing or something like that. But the important point we were taught was that to stop bleeding, you compress the wound.
And a shell dressing would be your part of your kit.
Yes, that's right. The stretcher bearer or the nursing orderly or the person tending to the injured carried a pack with dressings.
Now, is that all the bandages and dressings you'd learn at this stage, or would you have
the Thomas Splint? Famously, the Thomas Splint. We were taught the Thomas Splint.
Was that still in use? Or is it still in use today?
It was still in use when I was practicing medicine.
Now, what is the Thomas Splint?
Well, it's a ring that fits around the hip, goes into the groin, and comes up here. And it's a metal bar that goes beyond the end of the leg, and it's got a notch. It's bent so as to form a... what would you call it? A little valley in a dip in the metal, and what you do is you put the leg in, and you put bandages on to support the knee, and that was adjustable. Put a little bandage across to support the knee, and you would strap the ankle into it, and you would also put various things which, if they had a boot on, you would use the boot. If they didn't have a boot on, you would use adhesive dressings on the leg, and you'd have a Spanish windlass on the end. And the whole idea of a Thomas Splint was to put traction on a leg and immobilize it. If you don't put traction on, it doesn't immobilize. If you don't immobilize, the person can die of shock because they continue bleeding. If you've got a broken bone, and you're surrounded by muscle which is bruised and full of blood and also still active and therefore can move, and Also, if you move people around, as you move the bone, it causes more bleeding. You can actually die of blood loss, which is what shock is, simply by non-attention to a broken thigh bone. So what the reason for a Thomas splint was to immobilize practically and quickly in circumstances where there was no other things available. So that was the first action. If someone had a broken limb, it usually wasn't actually, they used to say tie both legs together. That doesn't work because you need two splints at least in order to immobilize. So that you could put the splint that side and use the other leg to splint a broken limb. But it still wasn't really very effective. Traction was necessary, and that's what the Thomas splint did. It produced traction as well as mobilization. Therefore, the bones, when they were in line, no longer rubbed against each other, no longer caused further bleeding. There were immobilization, although it's a single word, is a complex procedure. And involves putting lots of tissues at rest by putting a tolerable amount of tension on them.
Now, that sounds like a complicated procedure to put on. How long would it take to put a Thomas?
Oh, there used to be competitions. And this was one of the sort of highlights of the training that you would have. The class would be divided into Thomas splint teams. And I can't remember how long it used to take us to put them on, but it really was an astonishingly short time.
Was it a one-man job or a two-man job?
Oh, no, it's two. One person could put a Thomas splint on, but it was much more easily done with two. In particular, you slide the splint over the leg. There's no other way on. It's a ring at the top, and it's got to go up to the groin. So you've got to get hold of the leg, and someone holding the leg, you've got to ease the splint on and get on. There were various techniques about how to do it upside down and, hanging by your feet and things like that. All kinds of ingenious ways of making it slightly more interesting.
So, give us a rough idea of how long it would take to put on. Because, I mean, it would seem quite like half an hour.
Just a few minutes.
Yeah. And that would be fully done then?
Fully done, yes. And then it was judged as
did
to whether.
Did it hurt them? Obviously not in training. I mean.
Yes, it could be very painful to put a Thomas splint on. And I once put one on, but that was in hospital conditions and long after. But during the time I'm talking about, we always did it for practice. And it was quite uncomfortable for the unfortunate subject who was chosen to be the one receiving a Thomas splint as opposed to applying it.
Now, I thought these had faded out ages before then. I thought it was a First World War thing. I'm obviously completely wrong. When did it fade out? Was there a replacement method coming along that was already there? Or was it something that endured right into the 60s and 70s?
When I was at medical school, it was still in use in wards. A Thomas splint would be put on to exert traction on a broken femur. That's the thigh bone.
So that was standard procedure.
Yeah.
Would they then later on replace it with a proper plaster? If you see.
Yeah, they would take the splint off and put a plaster on for when the when mobilization was considered to be feasible. They would put plasters on, things like that. But generally speaking, if you broke a femur, it would be several weeks in bed with a Thomas splint on.
And a femur is a thigh.
Yeah, thigh bone.
So that's one sort of splint. Mm-hmm. And that was particularly for the femur, yeah. not that bit.
And there was the other splint was called a Gooch splint.
Spelled?
G-O-O-C-H. And it looked like a metal ladder. It was two rods of metal with some curved wire rungs between. And that was flexible, you could bend it. And so you put it on arms and things like that. So if you wanted to keep an arm like that, you would put a Gooch splint on and then just strap it on.
And what about this bit of the leg, the lower bit? Would that be?
Generally speaking, you would still... I can't remember, but you did, generally speaking, you put a Thomas splint on.
So the whole of the leg, yes. You were liable for that.
The point about immobilization is that you've got to immobilize one joint above and one joint below. But there are certain things where you've got to go beyond because it's still ineffective even if you immobilize the joints above and below. And so the tendency was, or necessity was, in order to achieve adequate immobilization, to immobilize more rather than less.
So that's bandages, dressings, and these two splints. Mm-hmm. Anything else you were learning? This is pretty.
We were taught artificial respiration, as it was called, and it was totally ineffective methods.
Tell us what method, because methods have changed, I think.
Yeah. But I've forgotten the names now. They had eponymous names, and there was a means that you to squeeze the chest, put them into the prone position and clear the seaweed and various other things out of their mouths and then squeeze their chest, put them lying on their prone like that, and you do this, and they were taught how to do it and practiced it, and it seemed to work, but it was always with conscious subjects who weren't actually drowned. And then there was the other method, which you'd move the arms up and down, supposed to elevate the chest. Neither of those were very effective, but we believed in them and we practiced them and got to do them very well.
And you didn't, there was none of this breathing in?
Mouth to mouth was never mentioned. Mouth to mouth respiration, artificial respiration and cardiac massage were not done, were never mentioned, weren't even thought of as.
They hadn't been invented.
It hadn't been rediscovered, shall we say. The whole idea of mouth to mouth respiration was based on the realization that methods of artificial respiration, more ethical methods of artificial respiration, didn't work. People continued to die. So someone had the idea of blowing into the mouth. And there also, external cardiac massage was not considered to be even effective. It, if you needed to massage the heart, and this was even true when I was at medical school, where to do is to open the chest and massage the heart with your hand. Heroic measures. But if the heart stopped, that's what you did. And I've actually seen it done.
We'll have to come back to that. I mean, now, so anything else about in this thing, or should we move on to things? I wonder whether you were also taught as nursing orderlies about things like hygiene and
yes, we did have. Yes, we did have hygiene lectures and so
now,
on.
How far was hygiene going then? I mean, what level of hygiene and were the measures effective?
We were taught about latrines, various latrine construction.
As nursing orderly?
Yeah, well, really for information. We weren't required to construct them, but we were taught where they were necessary to be and things like that. And I think that was just sort of information. There was very little in terms of practical work. Just this is what else were we taught?
Well, I was thinking about things like washing, keeping things clean. You were taught all that, disinfecting, or was that not?
We were taught about sterilizing things in hospital and first aid and casualty all the various organizations which the RMC ran, casualty clearing posts and dressing stations and so on, would involve keeping things clean, and we were taught how to do that.
And what medium of sterilisation were they using at the
boilers.
Time?
Boilers. That is,
boil things.
Boil things, yes. And you used forceps called Cheetle's forceps, which are great long things for picking things that are boiling hot out of these boiling sterilizers of various sizes depending on the upon the size of the organization, so that a regimental aid post would have a small one and a dressing station would have a big one, but they all looked exactly the same. It was a thing looked like a fish kettle, and you pressed a lever and up it came with all the stuff that had been boiled for 20 minutes and was guaranteed sterile.
And was there an antiseptic agent, or think what they're called. It's going to make
disinfectant.
Disinfectant. I mean, was there a particular type that was used, or brand, or was it just?
No, we just there wasn't any sort of preferred thing. Jay's fluid, Dettol, and for use on people, there was Usol, Edinburgh University solution, which was a chloride bleach type of thing, which was sufficiently dilute so as not to destroy human flesh, and sufficiently strong to destroy all the things that were trying to destroy human flesh.
Did it hurt?
Yes.
is that more as astringent, right? Worse than iodine and things like that?
No, it was because iodine and various other tinctures were very damaging. They would destroy tissue. So Edinburgh University solution was the a bit of brinkmanship, I suppose, getting as near to destroying human flesh without actually doing so as to catch all those germs that would survive things like just plain washing and so on. You know.
Were you taught hospital routines? I'm not sure what they are, but I mean,
yes, we were taught to make beds and things like that.
Well, was there a special way of making beds? Nurses have a special way.
Hospital corners. We were taught the whole thing. It's called hospital corners. You just sort of do them. My earliest memory of hospital corners is seeing shop assistants who would wrap parcels in brown paper. You know, the sort of thing where you just fold the ends down and you get these little triangular bits that fold over. Well, hospital corners is the same for bed sheets. And we were told how to make beds in hospital and with draw sheets so that you could pull them through so you didn't have to change the beds quite as often. A draw sheet would be, you'd take a piece of soiled sheet and pull it away from the patient and took it up as sort of a bit like a kind of toilet paper on built-in toilet paper on the bed, except it was rather broader. But it meant that you didn't have to strip the bed every time. And that's the standard hospital procedure in those days, and so we were taught that.
What about washing patients' bedpans?
Bed baths, we were taught that. Mm-hmm.
And how do you do a bed bath? People don't know until they've had one.
Right. You put a blanket over someone and you strip them naked. And then you start off at the top and you sort of shuffle around underneath the blanket so as to preserve their dignity until you sort of go past and get around to their feet. And you wash them and rinse them without ever removing the blanket altogether. So
well, did people bother about that in the army? I would have thought modesty was the least of their...
But you see, it also kept them warm. It's very... If you're wet... And poorly and cold, it's not very pleasant. So the idea of a blanket wasn't quite to preserve modesty, it was also to preserve heat.
Now, anything else you were learning from this nursing orderly manual? We'll pick other things up as we go on, I'm sure. But
It was the standard instruction manual, the Bible of nursing orderly class 3 instruction. Everything was in there. And you got a copy which you took with you throughout your national service.
Now, did you were interested in medicine? You'd wanted to study medicine. Did you find this lower level of medicine, nursing, in other words, which is?
I knew a lot of it to begin with because I'd been a Boy Scout. I haven't told you about that.
Well, tell us about the value of your Boy Scout experiences. I think we'll drop that in now because I should have picked that up.
Well, we did, Boy Scouts. Do badges, and I was very interested in woodcraft and so on. The adventurous idea of living in the woods and cooking and camping, all that sort of thing, had a great appeal. But also, so as to be useful, there would be first aid. It's one of the classic badges of the Boy Scouts. You got the first aid badge, and so we had lessons in first aid, which were more or less recapitulated by the nursing orderly class 3 with the extension of how to look after people when they were poorly instead of how to administer the first treatment. And so a lot of that wasn't new to me. And took it in easily. On the other hand, a fair number of things were newish.